The BBC presents My Music, a radio panel game devised by Edward J. Mason and Tony Schreier. And here's Steve Race to introduce the teams.
Thank you very much. My Music is a panel game, a game played in twos, as at Wimbledon, or for that matter, in the Arc. In competition, our first two, Ian Wallace and Dennis Norden. And our opposing two, John Amis and Frank Muir. The first round concerns twosomes as well. Gentlemen, Ian, you first. Who are these two?
Well, Steve, you know, this really brings back the old days of My Music, when for a long time, if you remember, I was always trying to bring in the fact that Glinka was the father of Russian opera.
Yes, there
were many times that I got Glinka composing something that he didn't have anything to do with at all.
Scheherazade, for instance.
Yes. But this time, I'm confidently predicting that these two are Ruslan and Ludmilla.
That's right, it's 1842 opera. As the newspapers would probably say, Ruslan and his constant companion Ludmilla. That's the way they put it these days, yeah. Ruslan and Ludmilla by Glinka gets you 2 marks. Dennis Norden, who are these duettists?
So taught me and hurt me, deceive me, desert me.
He did three words and was unmistakable.
So did she, and was unmistakable too.
Well, maybe to you, but I've dropped a Glinka on her. That was Sinatra, but I really don't know who the lady was.
In love, the way she sang song. It was Keely Smith, the other singer. Well, half a mark for Frank Sinatra, and for your second full mark, Dennis, which show did that song come from?
Kiss Me, Kate.
Yeah, so you've got 1.5 out of 2. John Amis, over to you. Another twosome, who are they? Any idea?
Tristan?
Yes,
and Isolde.
Yes, Tristan and his close friend Isolde. We would certainly say in the newspapers. And for your second mark, because you're rather knowledgeable about these things, when was it first performed?
Ha
ha ha ha. Ha ha ha. I'll give you a hint. It was June the 10th.
I should think in the 1860s.
Yes. Halfway through, would you think?
I should think so.
Yes, absolutely right. Yes, 1865. Yes, and that gets you 2 marks. Frank Muir, for you, a different kind of opera. Who are the singers?
Thanks, money, Mr. Weinmann.
Yes, I thought that's what you said. You could rarely strike me dead, you know. You're giving a fortune out of the blue, thousands of pounds, and what do?
Give it away to anyone you can find.
Mr. Stanhope. You're out of your mind.
Who were they?
Derek Nimmo.
Yes. Guest in your programmes often enough. Derek Nimmo and the other singer.
Is it from show I always thought was the history of pin-ups, the Charlie Girl.
Yes, it was from Charlie Girl, yes.
Well, it wasn't Liverpudlian, so it wasn't Jerry Marsden, so presumably it was the original Joe Brown.
Joe Brown was the other singer, and you've got 2 marks. Very good. Miscellaneous questions about music. Ian, the musical profession these days is full of film composers, as any film composer will tell you. But do you know who was the first composer to write a score specifically for a film?
Oh, yes. I was going to say, it could have been almost anybody when the first lady sat down at the first upright piano in the pit of the first cinema. I mean, it could have been Mozart. He was well ahead of his time, anyway.
Well, he wasn't that ahead of his time.
No, the first who actually wrote a score for a film.
For a film, yes. Somebody said, write a score of music to suit the characters and actors in my film.
There's a Czech composer called Kodály.
No.
I don't suppose he had a relative called Kodak.
Ingenious.
Al Jolson.
No, it's
he
one
was
of
in the first musical film. He wrote some of the numbers.
No, long before. And it's one of those things one either does or doesn't know. And it's worth the mark in your case to find out, isn't it?
Oh, sure.
The first composer to write a score specifically for a film was Saint-Saëns in 1908. And the film was called L'Assassinat du Duc de Guise. Can't give you a mark. Dennis, where might you find a swell oboe?
In a film called, called Easter Parade, where Judy Garland and Fred Astaire both dressed up as oboes and they sang "We're a Couple of Swells."
I wondered what you might say, but I hadn't wondered that. I hadn't got around to wondering that.
No, because I hadn't got around to...
It's not an oboe... No, it can't be an oboe swell on an organ. That's ridiculous.
Yes, a swell oboe on an organ.
Well,
yes. Yes, ridiculous or not, you've got a mark. Dennis had the mark anyway, yes. Incidentally, a swell oboe pipe, along with a piccolo and three tuba solos, was stolen from Derby Cathedral in June 1973.
Is nothing sacred.
Is nothing sacred,
I thought you'd find a swell oboe on a dude organ.
John, he was 12 when the first gramophone records were made. 96 years later, 5 months after his death, his own music became available at last on records. Who was he? It was...
Havergal Brian.
Dr. Havergal Brian, yes, whose symphonies numbers 10 and 21 were issued on an LP in May 1973, 5 months after his death. Wonderful old chap, Havergal Brian.
I had a rather nice interview with him, and... Robert Simpson was talking to him and said, did your wife go along with you? Did she like music? And he said, yes. Oh, she liked music, up to a point. He said, I think up to about Brahms' third symphony. I don't think she would have liked the fourth. Well, I had a sort of view of some tremendous chasm between two symphonies, which Mrs. Brown couldn't quite leap over.
I was present at the Albert Hall in 1966, wasn't it, when Havergal Brian's enormous symphony, I forget which number it is, was performed. He wrote it in the year in which I was born, and he had to wait until 1966 to hear it performed. And I remember after it had been done, we all applauded, of course, and kept on applauding at the Albert Hall, and then this tiny little old man, well into his 90s, came on the stage and stood there looking somehow rather bemused. And I remember he looked as though he'd been screwed to the floor. And I thought, yes, my friend, you've waited for this all my lifetime. As long as you care to stand there, I'll go on applauding. And we did. We kept him there, and he obviously soaked up all the applause that he'd so much merited and not had over the previous 50 years, or however many years it was. Marvellous. Frank, your question. A composer working on a new piece wrote to his friend, it is very noisy, has no great artistic value, and I am composing it without much enthusiasm. What was the work in question? It wasn't one
was
of them.
Was he writing in English?
No.
Then why did you say it in English?
Because you would not have understood it in Russian.
True. It's the sort of thing
it's a Russian composer. Russian composer.
Yes.
It's noisy. I thought it was Till Eulenspiel. That's a nice noisy bit, isn't it? Mm, bang that big drum in the middle.
Comparably noisy.
So it's something...
Czech.
Is it the... dum bong. Dum dum bells bong de cannon.
Well, I'm going to give you a mark. It was, in fact, Tchaikovsky writing to Madame von Meck about this. You're right, 1812 Overture, and that was what he wrote. It is very noisy, has no great artistic value, and I'm composing it without much enthusiasm. On now, back to you again, Ian. Mood music, an expression that's used in films and television for orchestral music written by the yard to induce a certain mood in the listener. I'm going to play to each of you about 15 seconds of mood music, and I want you, please, to come in when it's over, either with a description of the scene at that point or the actual commentary or even perhaps dialogue that you might expect to hear. So, Ian, here's some mood music for you.
There is enough acid in your stomach. To burn a hole in the carpet. But you do not need to endure those terrible post-luncheon and dinner pains if you take Bicobats. They will soothe away all that acid and turn it into a beautiful, soothing alkali within 5 minutes.
Yes, I'll accept that. Yes, 2 marks to you. The composer Tom Disavelt, in his dull way, called it ignition. I'm sure he'd rather have called it whatever your product was called.
Steve, will you tell us when we get to the one that you compose so that... Because it's rather nasty when we take the mickey out of other composers.
Well, it's kind of you to point out that I usually slip one of mine.
Yes.
You know, and I'll return the kindness by telling you that it's yours, and here it is. Here it is.
Somehow, I couldn't face going back to that empty apartment. I said to the bartender, slip me another shot of rye. And then I saw her. She was leaning up against a letterbox with the breeze riffling through her crew cut. I looked at her. She had a full, ripe body, eyes that a man could drown in, red, wet, pouting lips. And yet there was something about her I liked.
Do you know, I thought at first you were going to get a succession of laughs by quoting the actual script of, was it Farewell, My Lovely? Was
or
it?
The Big Sleep.
Yeah, Big Sleep, one of those, yeah. Yes, I, in my innocence, called it Big City Blues, but you've certainly got the right idea in 2 marks. John, here's one for you, and I didn't write it.
Day that the circus hit town.
Yes, would do as a title. Any idea how the dialogue would go, or?
Well, my trouble is I have to sweep up after the horses, but thank God it ain't the elephants.
We're all right then, yes. 2 marks to you. Paul Fennelly, the composer, called it Horses for Courses. Frank, here's some music for you.
We apologise for the breakdown in transmission. We hope you enjoyed the music. And now back to the studio and panorama.
Gets you 2 marks. Matter of fact, everybody gets 2 marks in that particular round. The composer was Jack Coles. The piece was called Bow and Curtsy. And at this point in the show, let's have a look at the score. And I see that leading by 1.5 marks at the moment are John Amis and Frank Muir. Right, let's get back to opera and operetta. Ian, what took place on December the 30th, 1879, at the Bijou Theatre, Paignton, Devonshire?
Oh, a very happy evening that was. Mm. Well, what really took place was some curious way of avoiding the law of copyright.
Well, not so much avoiding it as establishing it.
Establishing it, yes. Mm, but, yeah. Yes, the law of copyright was involved because, I don't know quite whether it was just before they produced The Pirates of Penzance in America or before they did it at the Opéra Comique, which is where it had its debut in London. But at the Bijou Theatre, Paignton, that was the first place that ever saw or heard The Pirates of Penzance.
To establish copyright, that's right. It was at Paignton, there down in Devonshire, because the Doyley Cart Company was doing a season in Torquay. Gets you what a mark, I think, for that one, yes. Dennis, we're going to hear now from the pirates themselves. Dennis, the question for you. They wanted to copyright the cheer, you see. Foiled again. Dennis, the question to you, why were the pirates so bad at their job?
Well, as far as any performance of Gilbert and Sullivan that I've ever seen, which Captain Cook could count on the fingers of his bad hand, it's because most of them are bank clerks and accountants and solicitors during the day, daytime. That they were bad at their job is established by the fact they didn't wait for the chairman to stop talking before they came in and interrupted him there, didn't they? And now the message is coming through.
Yes, Ian, you're...
The moving finger writes, and having writ, I will move on. Yes. And I'll start the first eight lines of the answer. They were notoriously soft-hearted and were, in fact, members of the, it looks like, gynocracy, that can't, aristocracy, who had stayed from,
Ian,
strayed
you
from
just
the path
it?
Of wrecked. They had stayed, we got as far as wrecked, and then the moving finger stopped and didn't move, etude.
Well, the fact is, they were too tender-hearted. They said they would never rob an orphan, if you remember, and whenever they got into took over a ship, word had got ahead of them, and they found that all the members of the ship's company were orphans, so they couldn't rob any of them. No, rather
I think
nice.
The other delightful part of the pirates, unless you're going on to ask somebody else something about the pirates.
I am.
Oh, you are? Well, I'll shut up.
Yes. Tell us, I'll come back to you later, perhaps. Yeah. John, here is another song from the Pirates of Penzance.
The Major General comes, so quickly hide.
Yes, yes, the Major General comes.
Yes, yes. The Major General comes.
Yes, yes, the Major General comes.
John, who comes in at that point?
Just his rank.
No, I'd like his name as well, please.
Oh, I see. I thought you were making it nice and easy for me. I am a Major General.
Not Major General Livingston, I presume.
No, I don't know.
You don't know. I couldn't have given you it more clearly than that. Major General Stanley, it was, actually. Do you know who he was, what relationship he bore to somebody else in the show? Or what kind of a Major General he was? That would do.
I was very little when I saw these shows.
Yes, I know, yes.
He was the very model of a modern Major General.
Yes, that's right. Well, I think half a mark, then. He was the very model.
He was somebody's daddy, wasn't he?
He was the heroine's, yes, Mabel's father.
Mabel's, right.
Yes, half a mark out of one, if you didn't know his name. Frank, can you explain this scene?
Upon my word, this is most curious, most absurdly whimsical. 5 1/4.
5 1/4. Oh, it's a very tedious Gilbertian joke, this, that he's supposed to be... It's Fred.
Yes,
it's Fred. The apprentice pirate. And he's supposed to be... cease to be an apprentice when he's 21, but he's born in leap year, you see. He was born on February 29th. So although he thinks he's 21, he's only had 5 1/4 birthdays, you see. Yes. He goes on and on about it. And, a paradox, the most exciting paradox. All this.
Yes. You don't think much of Gilbert?
No.
Well, yeah, but not then.
Oh, I see.
It was one of his lapses.
This is actually what Frederick goes on to sing at that point.
I am a little boy of five.
paradox, very risible, as Frank pointed out. Mm-hmm. And on to the next round. I read somewhere that the Guild of Circus Clowns has adopted the song Be a Clown as its official theme music, and I wondered whether people perhaps in other walks of life might feel disposed to adopt a signature tune of their own. Road users, for instance. So how about a song for the Guild of Lady Drivers? Let's give it, well, Ian, I'll give you a rest for answering first, because you always get these questions first. John, you first. A signature tune for the Guild of Lady Drivers. What would be suitable, do you think, for them?
I don't know where I'm going. I've no idea where to park, dear.
Well, all right, yes. Frank, something for
the... I'm riding along on the crest of the road and no one can pass me by.
I think we'd better leave by a different door or something.
Or yeah. How about dense, dense, dense little lady?
Oh, that's clever, yes, I like that. I'd prefer that, actually, yes, that's for your two, Mark.
I'll have that one.
Ian, yes, I'll have that one. Ian, any ideas yet?
Well, I am married to an extremely good driver.
Aren't we all, dear? Aren't we all?
And I drive a great deal in the course of a year, and I find that, on the whole, I'm more scared by men drivers than by lady drivers. So I'm going to be very careful on this one. But with the little possible warning that love is just around the corner.
Oh, that's nice, yes, rather sweet. Dennis, the
Guild I think we are statistic. I think statistics show that actually we're being male chauvinists, if not pigs, road hogs. Anyway, I think where lady drivers do show up more is in the garage when they bring the car in with something wrong with it. That's possibly when they're less at ease. Two suggestions. One is, I know you remember a song, "This is my first repair, so please be kind." And the other one was "a tisket, a tasket, I think I've blown a gasket."
Right, yes. Yes. Ah, very nice. With more time to think about it, I wondered about "Back in Your Own Backyard," perhaps, yeah. or "I'm Always on the Outside." But we want it to be understood that we don't really mean any of this. We think lady drivers are marvellous, and we're all married to good drivers, aren't we? Aren't we? Yes. Right. Finally, some singing. Dennis, you first. Yours is a three-letter word. Jack Buchanan leads you in. See if you can take the song through to the end for 2 marks.
Dreams I know can never come true. Seem their soul I'd ever be blue.
Who means my happiness? Who would I... Whom would I answer to? Well, you'll never guess whom. No one but you.
Yes. 2 marks to you. John, again, a three-letter word, spelt Z-I-G. One of the world's most famous tunes, I think from your expression you may know it, one of the world's most famous tunes is called Ziggy Ziggy Zig. And can you sing it, please, for 2 marks?
Zig 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 zig.
Well, that's not quite the right words.
No, very
it's the right tune,
song, which Kathy Barbarian sings.
Yes, there's a bit later on, da di da 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 di, le vent du vent souffle, something like that. Do you know that bit?
Yes, la dame dit-on, c'est une baronne, marquise ou baronne. Becomes a rather snobbish little story about a little orgy that's going on at night. But my favourite line, yes? My favourite line, death is there too, to provide the third person of the
really?
Audience.
Really? Mm.
But there's a wonderful line at the end when all of a sudden it stops, and da 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 boing, and the line is, mais, psst, tout à coup, la coque a chanté.
Ah, yes.
And it ends up something like, et vive la mort et l'égalité.
The tune being, did anyone in the audience recognise the tune? Yes, thank you, somebody did. Danse Macabre was the tune, and Ziggy Ziggy Zig is the vocal version. Frank, Jack Buchanan again leads you in.
Just a moment, you've got the wrong tempo for me, haven't you? Don't expect me to sing it in waltz time, surely. Oh, well, all right. Na 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 I'll wait till you're all through. Ah.
Frank.
You must say yes to Mr. Brown.
Yes.
No more, less to Mr. Brown.
It's his key, not yours.
He is the great white chief, you know. And those are all the words I know.
Yes.
Key trouble.
Well, it becomes key is not Muir's key, I'm afraid. Mm. Ian, we can't let you go without hearing your favourite three-letter word. So good, I always think for blood cooling. May I give you a chord?
Do. Mud, mud, glorious mud. Nothing quite like it for cooling the blood. So follow me, follow, down to the hollow, and there let us wallow in glorious mud.
And so we end my music with a wallow in glorious mud and a victory by one mark, I see, for John Amis and Frank Muir. Goodbye.
Taking part in My Music were John Amis, Frank Muir, Dennis Norden, and Ian Wallace. The questions were compiled by our chairman, Steve Race, and the program was produced for the BBC by Tony Shryan.
You've been listening to My Music from the BBC, each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.